Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts...
Canis Albinus.
Sedwick.
Speaking of trolling, shall we get on with this?
Oh yeah, since we're on the deadline, yeah, we probably should.
Let's get it on! Episode 294 of Polycast, with talk about Civ that matters to you. Let's meet our hosts. Dan Q is absent from the panel this morning, recuperating from moving into a new home yesterday, in which he lived with his fiancée. I remember what that was like. So, filling in for him, a guy who doesn't complain too much, he's Canis Albinus.
Shiny!
Don't conquer Kabul or Carthage in the early game, or your head will look good on the end of a pole to Mad Jin.
All right. We all know what Dan's really doing instead of recording this.
Getting out of around those annoying Spanish missionaries by making like an AI and heading into the water, he's the Mian Team.
It's not the only thing that's going to be put in the water.
You'll have to offer all of your luxury resources before she'll consider trading you her coffee. She's Makalua.
I love this introduction. We need you every week.
And finally, your first words to this guest host in the multiplayer chat exchange were, "What the hell is taking your turn so long?" I'm Sedwick.
We got Indonesia in the new fall patch. The unique ability of Great Nusantara. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but minor adjacency for coastal tiles to the holy site, the campus, industrial zone, and theater square, and plus one amenity to each entertainment complex adjacent to a coastal tile. So in other words, for Indonesia, just build all your districts on the coast, okay?
Yeah, pretty much.
So right now they're led by Gitarja. Or guitar, I don't know. That's a hard one to pronounce. Her unique ability is Exalted Goddess of the Three Worlds. Naval units can be purchased with faith. Religious units pay no movement to embark or disembark. And plus two faith to city centers that are adjacent to the coast. So also put your city on the coast. They do have the drawing replacing the frigate. Once you put it together, it gets a formation bonus. So if you see there are navy coming towards you, you might want to take care of it a little faster than normal. Because it's also plus one movement to the regular frigates as well.
Mm-hmm. Coming at mercenaries, it's a lot quicker to get. Much easier to get to mercenaries than it is to get up to
square rigging.
Yeah, square rigging is that nice little tech on the end that you look up and you go, I should probably get frigates. In this case, nah.
No, just go to mercenaries.
Not gonna do it.
Yeah, set up your faith really high, then you can buy half of them with faith and half of them with a gold. And then you have an armada that Spain would be jealous of.
Add a couple extra theaters for giggles.
Yeah.
To speed your way in there, make sure you have a bunch of holy sites and then buy a bunch of units and rampage all over the coast because, well, no one else really has a navy, right?
Well, other people have navies, but they don't get such a powerful navy quite so fast.
This is kind of one of those, if you focus it, you'll definitely get there before everybody else gets actual frigates. Might still have to deal with some caravels, but whatever. Ranged units versus melee units, ranged always wins because you just mass stack them. And it's two range versus that silly one range quad grim. So
unless it skips the denial and everybody has 10 movement.
Well.
Yeah, range always wins only because that's how they set up the game.
Yeah.
And there's
you
no
like make them
terrain.
Do a tenth of the damage, then they'd be less viable, but I mean, come on.
Or make them be only one range. Then you can't stack nearly as many of them in there.
But then you're in melee range all the time and just get wailed on. It's tough to balance range in the format that Civ uses.
Yeah. So, yes, go culture and faith and you can have a big navy pretty quick. Goddess of the Three Worlds is pretty good. Religious students not paying movement to embark or disembark is kind of one of those, that's nice. Whatever.
Yeah, it's not massive to your strategy, but when you're trying to spread everything around, it's like nice that they don't have to wait to go doop across this and doop across that.
Yeah, they're the berserkers of the religious world.
When you're greasing other human players by sending them your religion in a supposedly co-op game, you can use that to duck them attacking your religious units by diving into the water.
Yep. Oh, look, you have a lake next to your city. Yoink!
Exactly. I'm in a lake. You can't get me.
Yeah. So their unique improvement, given that you want to put a bunch of districts on the coast. Basically, it's Japan. You just don't get the bonuses for them being squished together, but you definitely want them on the coast.
Yeah,
so the unique improvement needs to be placed on coastal tiles, you know, in that water.
Especially there's something when you've that got improves other water. Sea resources around it, too.
Yes, but there's something that improves water.
Finally.
Yay.
The real question is having enough workers to do that, builders.
Well, I mean, you get an extra production and an extra food for each adjacent fishing boat. So provided you're settling on the coast on purpose to get those sea resources, then, you know, you can slip a few of these in next to those and make that a little bit better. Especially if you get all those other bonuses. As long as you also go for those other things that boost up the water resources, these things can just give you that extra little bit that'll be very useful, especially the housing on the coast side, because obviously you're not going to be farming nearly as much in the water.
Yep, you can just hit your bonus tiles like the wheat and rice and ignore everything else.
Water farms.
Yay! That one housing is more than two farms. It takes two farms to get one housing, so it's more efficient on the housing side to be closer to the water. When it comes to against Indonesia, get in there, build a navy, and burn their coasts down. Pretty much.
Preferably get your navy before they do, because they're going to fuck you up a little bit if you let them get there.
Yep.
Water, meat, fire.
Yeah, pretty much. They will provide you a ton of stuff to pillage in the water, so that's a lot of healing, because the fishing boats gives you health for your boats, so you can sit there and pound their shores more. If you're playing Norway, dive across the ocean. Just mass rampage and pillage, because all their districts will be on the coast, so it'll be easier to get onto the districts. And at least faster to get onto the districts to pillage them. So don't forget to get your pillage civics, so you can maximize your pillaging. And obviously focus on their faith first. That way they can't have it. Can't buy faithful navies if they don't have any holy sites. And if they do manage to get mercs and their jung, just make it a land war.
They wouldn't have anything other than just the normal basic units.
Well, if we are playing an islands map and the island's big enough, because most of them, the island plates maps tend to be much bigger, then you just have to get onto the landmass that they're on and then stay away from the coast so that their frigates can't shoot you. But then you can just rampage around, because they don't have any. If they focused on getting to the jump, then they probably won't have much in the way of melee units or other upgrades.
Out tech them. So with Khmer, you probably want to build some aqueducts and put farms near them. You do get an amenity for it in faith and more food for fewer builder charges. So that's something to do as. They're not led by Suri Avarman, but they are led by Avarman. And he gives you +2 food and +1 housing for holy sites if placed on a river. So this is a religious focused civ, as we covered last time. Use it if you want. I don't like religious focused civs, but go ahead. Have fun with it. The culture bomb with the holy site can be nice trolling, though. Again, if you're in co-op-ish, then a little bit of extra ish there. And the other human players can't do anything about it, because they would be the attacker.
Except that they'd be laughing at you if you try and holy site bomb at 3 range, because apparently people have checked and culture bombs don't work outside of your 3 range.
Oh, okay. Well, you can still troll people with that. You have to plan your trolling more carefully. It's a good tip.
Or at least to maximize the culture bomb, it has to be, you have to put your holy site max 2 distance away from your capital.
Yeah.
If you try and put it 3 away, then you don't get the stuff out in the 4 range.
Well, fair enough. So when you forward settle the other human player, you need to do so aggressively so that when you steal their tiles, it's within your 3 range. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So their unique siege unit, it's unlocking with military engineering. They seem kind of cool. The ability to move and shoot is nice. If you're fighting them, well, as usual, don't face tank enemy armies with your cities, and you'll be fine. Maybe you want to put some units between your enemy and your city, and in that case, this is probably not as good as a crossbow. Keep them away from your cities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the fact that they also exert zone of controls can slow things down.
They can, but you really don't want to be defending with siege units, right?
Well, no, not really. But it just means that, say, somebody shot one of your units and you need to get it away from the front line and you run it behind the siege units, well, these things will at least prevent people from running it down.
Unless they have something that ignores it.
Mm, true.
Which they probably do, but it's there.
Well, knights eventually exert zone of control, so.
Yeah. And then you got the temple, the special temple at the same yield, but you get martyr promotion. So more religious stuff that side of the game. You get a relic slot, too, if you're interested in pseudo-victory conditions.
No, the best part is that missionaries get the martyr promotion. Missionaries are cheaper. Missionary spam is still a thing with these guys. You just, oh, I need a new relic? Okay, I'll just buy a missionary, get a free thing, and just have it run around and wait for the AI to blow it up, get a free martyr. It's much easier to lose a missionary than it is to lose an apostle.
That's true. And you'll have a slot for that relic, so there you go.
Yep.
And as for countering that, I guess just kill them, because they're building missionaries.
I'll show you a relic.
I mean, there's not a lot to say about that in the religious game, I guess.
Well, I mean, obviously playing as Khmer, then the founder belief that really boosts out your relics is the obvious one. If you're going to be placing holy sites on rivers, then you might as well take the river goddess pantheon that gives you an extra amenity for holy sites on rivers.
You'll probably need it with the food, too.
Yeah, because you're going to get extra food and extra housing. So, yes, you're going to grow just that little bit faster. Yeah, you'll probably want that extra point of amenity. Farms providing 2 food if adjacent to an aqueduct. People looked at that. You're a maximum 4 farms next to an aqueduct. Because, obviously, aqueduct needs to be next to your city and next to a water source or a river. So, if it's on a river, then maybe you can get an extra couple. But
a river is a water source?
Yep, obviously. But normally, you don't build aqueducts if you're on a river. Because, well, you already have pretty much everything.
But would you as Khmer? I didn't.
I think it's basically the same thing as Rome.
You
would never build it except, hey, look, we get lots of stuff if we build one of these. And they don't district scale. They're always flat cost.
So they're usually pretty cheap to pick up at some point once you have an established city.
Yep. So you might as well. Because, again, it's an extra point of amenity and faith.
Yep.
Obviously, you can skip the making your apostles martyrs. You don't have to worry about that. You could go for cheaper missionary spam. You might have to, depending on how far away you have to go to martyr your missionaries. Keeping in mind, if you're doing it too close to your own territory, you're just going to lose your religion.
Yeah.
As for that against Khmer, if you can get a bunch of apostles over to near Khmer and they start spamming missionaries because they want martyr promotion relics, well, just make sure you kill all their missionaries next to their cities and poof goes their religion. Otherwise, they're focused on economy side of things, food, housing, amenities.
Yeah.
So they're going to be kind of solid, but they get no real military bonuses. They get no science bonus other than, well, more people.
Although there are not many civs that get a major science bonus, so they're not too far behind in that.
Yeah, I guess just keep in mind that when you take over a Khmer city, you find that the city doesn't have enough food for the population that's there.
Yeah.
What about war weariness? Victoria over on CFC has actually spent some time looking into it. She's been checking out all the different stuff, like when you get it, how do you lose it? Relatively decent summary or figuring out where things go. Accumulation of war weariness points. So there's 2 things. There's the war weariness negative amenity that happens while you're fighting. Eventually it gets applied to a city. That's war weariness. War weariness points, which she talks about a lot more because, well, that's the underlying stuff. That's what builds up before you get one of those points. So there you go. Of course, you get war weariness from fighting and a little bit from declaring wars, depending on the type of war, apparently. So if you have formal war versus surprise war, people are a little bit more upset about surprise wars than formal wars, obviously. And there's a multiplier in there for CB. So if you use an actual CB, it's less war weariness versus just a straight formal war. Location, 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 very obvious location. You take some war weariness if you're in your borders. You take more if it's elsewhere or if you're getting whacked by a city or something along that line.
Yeah, it's a game abstraction to help you out with being defender, because you're usually not at an advantage if the person attacking you is competent.
Yeah,
if you're on the defense. And yeah, it looks like it's roughly double. That's not a perfect rule of thumb, but.
And of course, losing units is actually way worse, obviously. And losing units abroad is even more worse. So if you declare war and then you go across the seas, start losing a bunch of units over there, your people are a little upset at you. But if you lose somebody defending home, well, it's bad because you lost somebody, but it's not as bad. So keeping units alive, even if you have to run away, is a little safer on your war weariness and then the loss of amenities while you're fighting.
Although two fights abroad is worth a death at home, so you really want to win your wars without making them take an eternity.
Yep. Keeping in mind, you have to have some fights before you get a death, so...
Oh, yeah.
So there's so,
like,
that.
Yep. Every fight you do, like, if you're attacking, you're probably getting more war weariness than the defender, no matter what you do, if you're in their territory.
There is some adjustments in there. Being at war, you do lose a very small amount of war weariness per turn, which basically just means that if you stop fighting for a couple turns, you can make up for the fighting-based stuff, as long as you didn't die. So you can make up for some fighting at home if you are still at war, but you killed all the rushers. If somebody tries to rush you early game and you fight at home, and then they lose all their units, and you have to cross like a massive map just to go find out where the crap they were, because they're a dumb AI who attacks you across the map, you'll lose some war weariness points for all of that as you go. When you peace out, everybody loses an extra per turn. That's usually how it's like
on city states. Holy crap.
Yeah, there could be a small exploit in there.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I know how to work around war weariness and turncast games now.
Yep.
Minus 10k for declaring on another human player and making peace with them when they got four city state allies.
Yep.
That'll pretty well wipe out any war weariness you've accumulated, unless you really choked in your wars.
Yep. Keeping in mind that, provided it's the same as I remember, each war calculates war weariness points by itself. It's not just one giant pool. Each war is separate. So you lose war weariness points per turn against everybody when you're completely at peace, but you gain and lose war weariness points against each individual war based on your actions there. And that's why you can either skyrocket really quick or maintain war weariness, because you're not necessarily fighting some of those other wars that you happen to be in while you're prosecuting a single war. The city-state stuff, yeah, that looks like it's questionable coding, because you don't gain a huge amount when you declare war versus somebody who has a bunch of city-state allies. Maybe it shouldn't be quite as big of a number as that, because that's a little silly.
Or maybe they could just not put city-states in the computation when it comes to making peace. It wouldn't be that big of a deal.
Yeah. Yep. Because, yeah, I mean, if you attack a city-state, you're not going to be generating a huge amount of war awareness points. Like, to get to 2,000 war awareness points, that's a crap ton of fighting.
Yeah, especially because every turn you are making back 50. So you really have to be, like, fighting an extended war with lots of combats to
and
push
lots
yourself
of
over
city loss. Yeah, you have to be losing a crap ton of stuff to
or
get
just be in the industrial era.
Yeah. The longer the game goes on and the higher area you are, the higher war weariness generates.
But you also have more opportunities to end wars quickly.
Yep.
I guess some human Gandhi troll could just try to camp you or something. But in fact, this isn't something that you should be letting get bad.
Yeah, well, it still gets bad if you aren't managing your amenities. If all your cities at the beginning of the war all are at zero amenities and you're thinking, haha, I'm not negative, that's great, then yeah, you're going to take a hit staff. But if you're floating +3, +4 at the beginning of war, yeah, you're going to get war arenas points, but you're probably never going to have a city go negative, depending.
Avoid rebels, basically.
Yeah, should be pretty easy to avoid rebels.
Yeah.
He has a nice little graph here from war, because thankfully war awareness gets logged, and Victoria found the logs. It was able to graph some of it.
The statistician in me is screaming, why didn't you label the axes?
I know what the axes are. On the
I do too, but still, you label the axes. It's basic math.
Yeah, well, war awareness points is actually at the top of the war awareness points axis. So there's that. It's not necessarily meant to be there, because it's the name of the graph. So obviously more war weariness points across the bottom of the scale from fighting and killing units and taking cities. Obviously the person losing cities and units is going to get more over time, obviously, but you both end up getting a bunch. That's how you can war weariness your way into forcing somebody to quit a war, because you can just remove all their amenities and then just keep handing them more and more and more war weariness points until they basically lose more and start
That's
spawning
true.
Rebels.
But you have the ability to cut out all their amenities, like...
Yeah, some AIs...
probably going to get the job done anyway.
Some AIs and or humans refuse to make peace. So drive them into the dirt and let the rebels take care of it.
Fair enough. I'm just saying it's usually hard to get to their amenities unless you can do much more to them than just press their amenities.
Well, I mean, if you have a bunch of cav and you can sneak in, tap their amenities early in a war, go raiding. Raiding and pillaging, which has its value. And of course, nukes. Nukes have its own stuff. It's individually bigger, but not a huge amount. So using a nuke in the info age city gives about 624 weariness points, give or take. It's about the same as 6 combats abroad. So effectively, it's not quite 1 combat per hex. He says, nuking troops seems to be ignored completely for both sides. No weariness points. That to me seems more like a bug.
Well, it's just the act of launching it that's giving you the thing. But yeah, it is kind of awkward that you can nuke a city and they don't get war weariness.
Yeah.
Not even enough of the units?
Yeah.
This is fine.
It's okay. Well, I guess that's the thing. It could be the nuke side doesn't generate the war weariness points, but if you lose 6 units to a nuke, you should still gain the war weariness points for the 6 units.
I feel like that would be noted there if that was true, though.
Yeah, nukes may not have the correct coding involved to add war weariness points. I would not be surprised.
Well, the next line says they don't seem to be applied to cities at all, so...
Yeah, there might be something in the background happening that isn't getting logged, because obviously Victoria was trying to go off the logs, and the logs tend to have a lot of stuff, but if somebody was writing the code and didn't, say, put this out to the log, then it wouldn't show up there. So it'd be a lot harder to track down, especially since you're using war weariness points to build up towards actual war weariness. So if you don't gain a point of war weariness after an action, you can't visually see that something changed. Meanwhile, you could be like just below the level because somebody refused to log stuff. Otherwise, when you're at peace, war weariness goes down over time. So
pretty quickly too, 200 a turn. Yeah,
because obviously you're not at war. So you can just make peace and calm it down and go from there. Some strange behaviors, obviously. Declare war with Civ B and in the same turn, then make peace with Civ A for that turn. I get both war and peace decays for minus 250 war weariness points. I think that goes back to my comment that each war is tabulated separately.
Yeah.
If you were at war with Civ A, then the war weariness points related to Civ A are going to go down. Now, granted, they are tabulated separately, but whether or not in the coding somebody only applies the negative 200 for being at peace with Civ A to the war weariness points generated by Civ A rather than, oops, bad coding, keeps applying it until you have no war weariness points, that could be different things. But I'm pretty sure each of them are meant to have their own little pools. And by the summation of all those pools, that's where your war weariness overall is going to happen, which does make sense. People can get tired of fighting this enemy, but they're still great about smashing that other one that declared war on you.
Well, plus, you really don't want a situation where someone just gets ruined by being war-chained.
Yeah.
With each person just getting free rest in between.
Yep.
That one would suck.
But otherwise, in general, if you fight a war, you will gain war weariness over time, fighting both at home and abroad, but obviously fighting away from home is worse for your people. And of course, the later in the eras it is, the worse it'll be. What Victoria doesn't really get into is where war weariness gets applied.
Yeah, if you're fighting multiple wars, does the points from each add up and apply everywhere? Because, you know, the whole Civ, your whole Civ's at war, so wouldn't you all suffer?
Well, no, it's meant to be spread around in certain ways. More about your own cities versus cities you conquered. It's pretty obvious in game that, say, you conquer somebody's city, and then you keep fighting a war with them, all the war weariness points basically go to that city.
I see.
So the generalized concept is if you're fighting somebody, any cities they founded will gain the war weariness points first rather than cities you founded. But your cities you founded will still generally generate war weariness points. Now, granted, whether or not you get people to give up cities versus not in a war, in the peace deal, get them to concede them, that could also affect it. So if you get them to concede them, then they become yours in theory, which I don't think is quite accurate to what it's supposed to be, because in theory, it's always supposed to be somebody else's city unless you directly founded it. So there's some more questions on the back end that are a little harder to answer. One thing that's not talked about in this article is at what point do the war weariness points get converted over to actual amenity loss? Victoria says for every 400 war weariness points, you gain 1 war weariness, but that's not quite accurate per se. proximity to battle that I think may have failed to take into consideration if it's that person's cities that you're fighting versus somebody else's. Anywho, more work to be done to force Firaxis to actually tell you about mechanics.
The rules of the game, yeah.
Yeah. For some people who talk about building board games where you have to explain the rules, you'd think it'd be second nature to actually explain the rules.
You'd think. And you don't have to like put the details of the formulas there, but it should be obvious. Like just having the war weariness value there. So like when you fight them, you can see, oh, my war weariness went up by this amount of points when I did this.
There's a lot of details in there that just aren't in the Civpedia.
Yeah.
You want to talk about it? You want to talk about how to chop or whether to work the tile?
Well, you're going to work the tile probably.
Are you going to harvest the tile or are you going to chop the tile?
I'm chopping and harvesting the same thing.
Well.
Yeah, I thought that was a little bit strange too in our topic heading. Harvest or chop, huh?
Yeah, well.
I mean, maybe it's a question mark as to whether you do it at all. Like if you do one of those things or don't do one of those things. You can look at it that way and kind of get away with it. Still a little strange.
The apparent distinction is whether or not it's a bonus weight resource.
Yeah.
But I think it's mostly the same thing. How much hammers or how much food do you get from it?
Yeah.
The number one thing that seemed to come out of this is if you're going to harvest, make sure you're using the right policies so it doubles your overflow.
Of course.
Well, you want to be building stuff with bonus modifiers as much as you can get away with, really.
Yeah.
That's always an aiming point.
Plus 100% for naval units, plus 50% for certain types of other units.
Yeah.
Use those and then you chop into that and then, oh, look, your overflow got doubled because we weren't smart and decided that the whole hammer amount was the whole thing because overflow is a thing that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh, overflow in Civ games, in every Civ game, has been nonsense one way or the other.
Yep. It's always been a problem. Yeah, you can find a way to mass overflow and everything just goes bad.
And then use Goddess of the Harvest to get a bunch of faith, although that's kind of useless because faith is so cheap anyway.
Well, I mean, it depends. Earlier in the game, if you're hacking out the rainforest.
But why would you chop in the early game?
Because it's rainforest and it's in the way.
No.
Not to mention, early hammer bonuses gets you snowballing pretty quickly.
Yeah. The general concept is early yields out of chopping or whatever are low compared to late game. But in the early game, so what you're trying to put out is also
more.
Low. So... Yeah. The numbers are still sort of relative.
Victoria makes a note about double value tiles. So an early stone or river forest tile might be worth working, but later in the game near the end, you can remove the improvement with no builder charge and chop it for 200 or much more production. You know, when you see the end in sight, chopping everything is much better than leaving it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, masonry stuff. Yeah. Stone. It's great early game to work it. And then eventually, if it's stone on a hill or something like that, eventually switching it over to mine's actually better.
Yeah, you just get a better yield without any real downside, so you might as well do it.
And because it's later game, you get more. It's a nice end value for the game. Okay, if it's stone on a grassland tiles and it's actually reducing your overall production because you can't do something better, then maybe you don't necessarily want to chop it. But I guess if you're spitting out spaceship parts, whatever. Chop everything.
Because,
you know, when you're going to space, the best thing to do is to make the Earth one giant flat land because you pulled everything.
Got to build a fast driver somewhere.
Thanks, trees. See you later.
Yep. Thank you for building our spaceship out of wood.
You don't build the spaceship out of wood. You build the stuff that you test the spaceship with out of wood.
Uh-huh.
Because when you're building the spaceship part, you're not just building the part. You're building all the research that went into it.
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm just making fun. But in the generic original comment, you don't chop forests on a river.
Ever.
Until, obviously, you're chopping things to get whatever victory. But generally, the lumber mill on the river is just way better than a mine. In the same place. Or a farm in the same place, once you can. I mean, lumber mill on a hill on a river, that's a beauty for production early game. So,
it's pretty good at whole game through, really.
Yeah, that one stays pretty solid, actually. Mines barely touch it until the end game. Unless you get to the river valley, at which point, maybe.
Too expensive.
If you have a crap ton of mines, Thrur Valley is totally worth it. Use that city to just punch out whatever you want in the end game.
Yeah, especially when you have to build expensive things like spaceship parts. Having monster cities like that is really helpful.
Yep. I mean, yeah, individually, you'd look at it and go, okay, how long will it take for me to get the list production back? But if you're chopping a bunch of forests that are on hills that you didn't chop before, or rainforests on hills that you didn't chop before to get the Ruhr Valley made, and then you put in mines on top of that, then yeah, you can make it all back. But yeah, overflow really needs work every single game. The choice of it, to answer the original question, chop when you really want something. Don't, if you don't, get overflow. Never chop when you don't have something in your production queue. Because you get nothing. Yeah, if you have nothing in your production queue, you get nothing when you chop.
That's one of the dumb, most
annoying things ever.
Doesn't apply to the next thing you queue up, huh?
Nope, it just goes to nothing.
There's no input buffering.
Yep.
They got nowhere to store the wood.
Stupid input buffering.
Like, oh no, did we just burn down a forest? Did we get anything out of that? Nah, our workers were just a little bit too slow and they didn't feel like setting up that district yet. Oops.
Episode 293 with Dan Q, Takalua, the main team, Ad Jin, and Oz Benno.
Related to what we have already seen from Civilization VI and the patch, it really didn't take long for someone from Firaxis Games to start talking about what is to be, or at least alluding to what is to be, what could be.
Things and stuff and things. Well, someone specifically would be Ed Beach. But he gave an interview to PC Gamer teasing about what year 2 of Civ 6 is going to bring.
For those listening, why should anyone care who likes Civilization 6? Why should they care about what this Ed Beach guy has to say?
Because he's kind of the lead designer.
you heard it from Mackie. He's kind of the lead designer. Wow, Ed, you just got bam! Right in the back of the head, I tell you.
Oh, please.
I didn't even see it coming.
It's that figure of speech. Quit being so damn literal.
I thought you were going to say it pedantic, but sure. Yeah, that also works.
That too, yes. Can't spell pedantic without Dan, apparently. So apparently there's more of the interview that's going to come out next week, but what we've got so far, he was talking about, they're thinking about a World Congress for Zardars. Like, oh boy. He was careful not to, you know, be specific about that, you know, that's going to be a new diplomatic thing, you know. Because they got to keep something under wraps, as it were. They're going to keep making little additions like they have been. We're probably still going to get a fuller expansion type pack down the line. We're going to keep having little incremental things.
When Beach comments that we would have to wait for a larger expansion for us to add significant new gameplay systems like the World Congress.
Hint, hint.
You say that you need a larger expansion for that, and yet you also say that that's an area that you would like to get back to. So does 1 plus 1 equal 2?
Usually, unless you're dealing some really strange math. He does say that they are looking into putting more leaders with some of the existing system stuff, because specifically the interviewer was asking about things like Greece, because obviously there was, you know, in real life, that was a bunch of city-states, so can we have more, guys, please?
Well, that's definitely been the comment from some in the Civ community. It's like, right from the outset of the game, you have not only the ability, but you've demonstrated your intention of having multiple leaders by having Greece have multiple leaders, yet nobody else has that. So how about, rather than adding new civilizations, you just add some new leaders to existing civilizations, so all civilizations can have a second leader? It's kind of one of those things where I don't know if we want all in that case, because as extensive as a Civ game is, then what the heck would you add for abilities for even one leader of a new civilization necessarily. But I do agree that more than one civilization having more than one unique leader would be nice.
Yes. That may be in some of the little trickle bits we're going to get while they're working on whatever their big thing is.
And yes, you mentioned that next week as of this recording, so man, these people at PC Games End.
So about the time you're listening to this, they will have more of that interview with Ed Beach.
Yeah, there was probably from 2K to the interview, they're like, hey, they're these Polycast guys? Yeah, don't release your interview this week, the full one, okay? We got to keep them thrown off their game. Well then,
Good job throwing us off the game, I guess.
But not really, we're still talking about it. Lol. But they're going to go into more depth on the above, plus, quote-unquote, touch on modding multiplayer and expanding Civ 6 into all new territory for the series, unquote. Touch on, huh? Hey, Mr. Scott Jones? So they might not actually say anything.
Might be nothing at all.
They are going to go more in depth on what they have told us, but we don't know how deep that is, so we still may not be able to glean any meaning from the full release of the interview, but at least there's more to come for the interview, so hopefully we'll be able to get something out of that, even if it's ruling something out, because even if the interview rules something out, then you are still farther ahead.
PC Games decided that they wanted to have an interview with Ed Beach, and Ed Beach talked about his first year at Civ 6 and where he wants the franchise to go and the game to go, and he says all new directions, all kinds of fun stuff like that. He thinks it's going well, but he thinks that it needs work still, and everything is going the way he planned it would, which kind of scares me a little bit.
But, I planned it to be this bad. What?
He says that the end game still needs work because there's no barbs. Don't know what that...
What?
Yeah, kind of confusing. And he doesn't know about the World Congress, maybe coming back, maybe not. Depends on whether or not they decide to actually do what they think they're doing. And then there's an email that says, okay, well, 3 years of post-launch support for Civ 6, because that's what they did with Civ 5. So no surprises there.
Yeah, no big surprise.
He's looking to spice up the game a little bit in the late, and you know, he says there's not as much churn or turmoil as he'd like to see in a game that charts a full path through human history.
Yeah, I think context is Civ games in the past, just they make the base game and then they kind of bump up the areas that they think are a little weak or need some fun. But he may want to actually try and bump up all eras and all things to try and get a much fuller experience, because sometimes the early game is boring and quick. Sometimes the late game is a slog.
Always, in every Civ.
Yeah,
the game ends before time. Like, the game is over before it ends, always, in Civ. So.
Yep.
He says one of the things he wants to do is make the end game more dynamic, in that once the battle lines are drawn, something that can actually change that, which previously was like the ideology system, maybe, but that's not really around in this one, so we don't know what's coming yet.
Maybe some civs that steal some tiles. Macedon has no war weariness. Persia has surprise wars without penalty, that sort of thing.
Civil wars. That'll be great. Ugh.
Yay! Would you like to lose half your empire? And we're not going to tell you how it happens?
Okay. But it involves rebels.
No, I'd hope it involves more than rebels, because they already have rebels now and they suck.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll add like a minor nation to be rebels instead of it just being barbs.
Or something.
That'd be cool. Civ 4 had that and just didn't use it. I guess they might have had plans for that they never utilized. They had something called a minor nation, and it only showed up in some of the scenarios. But
and
it had like limited diplo.
If you managed to get in and see the leaderhead, it was always Cid.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
No, but I mean, if they had more alt leaders, then if you have a civil war, one of those alt leaders pops up and takes over the faction that you just lost.
Well, I think it would be bad if it's just like, oh, arbitrarily cut in half and everything else goes away. Maybe they should have to, like, take your cities or something. Make it something that you could actually fight back against rather than just, oh, well, I just randomly selected all your strong cities and took them away from you, and now you're all left with all your frontier stuff.
What is this, Crusader Kings 2?
Mm-hmm.
With elective Gavelkind or something?
Totally.
They said that there will be more leaders for certain civs.
Well, maybe certain civs.
And
it'd be really nice if they implemented alt leaders for every civ, because then it'd be cool.
They also said that they wanted to make sure that the fans could make them so they didn't have to make all of them forever.
Yeah. So we built the technology. You go forth and make the alt leaders. We are going back to the patch Redux. Woo! For the autumn patch, we're reduxing it. Talk about some undocumented changes that we didn't talk about before. Obviously,
like,
there's been a bit of time so that we can actually...
Suzeraining a city-state gives you their maps.
Yes, you get line of sight from city-states if you're their Suzerian now. Hey, I just popped up to this other continent because I'm playing a continents map, made a Suzerian of a city-state, and find out, hey, look, they actually know about all the continent. It's useful.
It's a nice extra.
Some talk about, obviously, the low religious preferences specifically as to some specific civs for that part of the patch, but what it is large preference reduction for faith yield and great profit pseudo yield. So instead of them just going like, we're not going to go for a religion, they actually dislike things that give them great profit points and faith yield, which could include some wonders. Something, city-states taken by other civs are getting raised. They weren't raised. City-states raising people, which is great.
Pillage districts no longer provide adjacency yields, and they drop adjacent appeal. So your citizens aren't going to want to look at that burning entertainment district.
What? The dumpster fire is no longer appealing? It really shouldn't have been giving adjacency bonuses if it's burnt to the ground.
And people should be upset about a dumpster fire.
Come on, who doesn't love a good dumpster fire?
Apparently the people in the dumpster.
Yeah.
In current game, we discovered an unfortunate change due to the religious model. You can't link a religious unit with a regular troop. Usually you wouldn't care, but playing as Spain, I just want my missionary to attach to my conquistadors means that I always have to move them separately, and definitely more than once I've forgotten to move the missionary onto the same tile, so I missed out on the plus 10 bonus. Hold on. Let's see if anybody answered that. Apparently that's a thing.
It's unfortunate.
So you can't link with traitors, spies, or religious units. But that's kind of obvious on the traitors and spies. More very obvious on the spies versus the traitors, but yeah. Yeah, that could be a problem. I mean, it's mostly a problem for Spain, not being able to link a religious unit. No one else really needs religious units attached. Oh, apparently there's a small UI change. Something about a notification box when there's stacked
declarations of war per day. Scroll between them.
Yeah, so if you press the button, it'll change.
I just wish the promotion notifications would disappear after I enact the promotion.
I just wish the promotion notifications would disappear if the unit died after getting the promotion. Yeah. Or while getting the promotion. Because it stays there. And you're like, I click on it. Nothing. Oops. Oh, something about stackingable things. So he was playing as Khmer, moving a Varu and a musketman. Ended up crossing on the same tile, stacked. But the next turn, couldn't fire the Varu until the musketman moved. The fact that they can stack, yes, that's not supposed to happen. And we've complained about the AI stacking up units and then doing stuff with them because you're not supposed to be able to do it. But if, say, you have two units in a city, you can't range shoot with a unit stacked with it. One of the units has to leave before you can use them. And that's usually where you see stacked units. And in some cases, the anti-stacking code can lock you from ending turn.
Yes, I have discovered that to my detriment. That, accidentally stacked a unit, couldn't end the turn. Game over.
Yep, you pretty much have to delete one of the units.
I didn't even think of that. Dang it. I just quit the game.
Oops.
Yeah, if you delete one of the two units, you're no longer stacked.
What if they're injured and in enemy territory?
Yeah, no, there's other issues.
Yeah, they're always the soft block yourself there.
Well, actually, I don't even sure Shift-Enter is allowed to bypass the anti-stack. So.
Unit needs orders.
Yep. I think that was mostly it for the undocumented stuff.
Amtrak Quebec wonders, why can't people in multiplayer play anything but Dom? It's just one small part of Civ. Why on earth is it that 99% of players don't have a clue about the rest of the game? You ask them stuff like the Great Zimbabwe, and they haven't the foggiest what it does. One simple answer: it takes too long. Yeah, currently, to achieve a religious, science, or cultural victory requires a really long time of people doing very little but managing their own civs. You know, at some point, you need to invest in an army. If only to hold off barbs, you may as well use it. Domination victory is one of the surest ways to interrupt other victory types. The game kind of creates an environment that skews toward military domination, and that makes most of the players focus on it to the expense of attending to tactics pertinent to other victory types. Thus, as forum user Selmuth commented, multiplayers won't bother to understand the other mechanics of the game, to the point of the original poster.
Still know what wonders do.
Yeah, because even if you're going Dom, some wonders like, I don't know, the Great Zimbabwe can give you a huge amount of cash to help pay for that Dom victory.
And every other victory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you can win Dom, you won any of the other victories, in effect.
Yeah.
It is the most efficient.
It's also a multiplayer. Domination is going to be the condition. One.
It's
going to be the
more
one
fun
that people go for.
If anybody is trying, they should try to interrupt other victory conditions, which precludes them.
Yeah, which generally requires an army to stop them.
Yeah,
what happens with our
multiplayer? It always comes back to Dom, ultimately.
Except for
well,
religion.
You can kill units, too. Like, religious units can't do crap against military units.
Yeah, but that's the thing. You could also, if somebody's going for a religious unit, you can spam religious units. and fight religiously.
Or you could declare on them and kill their religious units and hurt their religion.
Yeah, or just wipe out their cities. But when it comes to science and culture, if you're getting way behind in science and culture, you can't stop them from getting new science without stopping their science.
Yeah, what happens in modern multiplayers? We leave one AI just a little bit too long and they start developing the space race and it's like, oh crap. But hey, even if I only have knights, they can still pillage a spaceport.
Yeah, like Jollywalk was saying, domination is the first of the victory conditions. Everything after that is when domination fails.
And yet there's the question, how do you make the other kinds of victories more enticing to pursue in a multiplayer environment? Maybe could you make the military units do less damage to non-barbarians? You know, make warring objectives take longer, fighters get more war-weary sooner, but ranked ladder games are probably the best way to go.
Are you going for the, you want the game to last 20 years? Or
that's an issue. That's a trade-off.
Yeah, no, the whole point of multiplayer is to get it over with, generally, if you're going for competitive. Like, if you're trying to actually finish a game, and it's not just a, we're all just going to hang out and see who can get Space Race first, that's totally different. You're fun. But if you're playing against other people and you actually want to win the game in a certain amount of time, Dom's usually the answer.
Yeah, and then noting the game length, that's something that can best be fostered by a regular meeting of the same players over time. And the multiplayer environment where it's just, oh, I want to play now, let's jump in, that doesn't gel with that very well.
Yeah, when you're up against a bunch of random people from the internet, you're going to go for Dom just to go beat them up. Whereas, because we have our regular Saturday game, we could sit here one time and do a thing. It's like, okay, let's see who can get to Space Race first.
There's another option. Play with a rule set that precludes fighting, because, you know, there are rule sets in Civ 6 that allow that now.
Some ladders will foster that.
And it's also, if you're doing the no quitter thing, you're not going to sit there with one city and go, oh, maybe I should go for the space race now.
Not possible.
Yeah, you can have a group of people go together and like, okay, rules are, we're not actually going to fight. That's fine. You play that game. It's probably going to take a lot longer than a domination game, but
no, I mean like codified rules, like in the game, there's that game mode that's like,
Oh,
you only play with religious units. Can't fight in that game.
Well, yeah,
that's true.
But then you're doing a religious war game. So
different type of fighting.
Yeah. Different set of units. Same basic thing. You're playing for Dom.
We're fighting with lightning.
You can still disable different victory conditions, can't you?
You can.
You can't really disable domination victory.
Yeah, because people still build units and come kill you, and then you can't win your other victory.
Yeah, it's like, oh, the only victory we can go for is science or culture. Okay, now you have no cities. How are you going to win? Do.
Eventually, still wins.
What happens if you disable everything except time?
It's still military, because the person who is the only person with cities has the highest score.
Yeah. All right. I was having to think about that for a minute.
Yep. Nope. Dom still works.
The only time I've won a religious victory in MP was kind of by accident, because I'd spread my religion to the human players because they weren't bothering, and we got in the last of the AI, and boom, I win a religious victory.
Well, great mistake was thinking there could be any other way.
No, but it's true. I mean, the only reason you don't win a Dom victory is because somebody else built enough of a military to keep you from winning that way. And that's when the other victory conditions pop up. Although, if you can keep militaries, then religious kind of gets a little harder to happen. So goes down to science and culture. And that's kind of reality too. If somebody could have dominated the world, they would have done it by now. This whole culture and science thing would have took a nosedive.
Well, the fact that we have a strong military allows us to pursue that culture and science.
Yes, because otherwise somebody would have showed up and burned down
all their culture and science stuff instead.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about the fact that Take-Two would like to give us microtransactions. Great.
Okay, sure.
I kind of half went into this thread earlier this week and then just ran away.
Yeah, because in their conference call with their investors, they said they wanted to focus on things that have recurrent consumer spending, which basically that means microtransactions. Or in this case, I guess they want to do something like, with Civ, piecemeal out the DLC instead of giving us a proper expansion pack.
Isn't that what they've been doing since Civ 5?
I know, but at the same time, it's like, come on. We don't need this.
They said, we aim to have recurrent consumer spending opportunities, that's what they call it, for every title we put out at this company. It may not always be online or virtual currency model, but there will be some ability to engage in an ongoing basis with our titles after release across the board. There's an opportunity to monetize that engagement. There's a lot of room for growth. This is just the beginning. I'm scared, you guys. I am scared for the health and future of our beloved franchise because I have a feeling Civilization's current expansion packs, scenarios, and DLC as they work now aren't going to be enough to push all of Take-Two's greedy buttons, okay? Civ becomes a microtransactions game that has serious implications for the game experience, most notably the encouragement of a pay-to-win philosophy. What happens when a player is willing to pay so much more than his opponents that he can just buy his way to an unfair victory? I'd be more okay if I knew that there would be a game option to exclude microtransaction activities for players who still want that pure experience. And the games where it isn't disabled, those who pay their own money can still get what they're willing to pay for. But I fear Take-Two wouldn't be okay with such an option due to the lost revenues and the likelihood that most hardcore Civ players would be averse to microtransactions. Granted, that's probably a biased statement since I don't see myself wanting to do a bunch of them. I've been playing games 35 odd years. I prefer to pay X amount of money up front and milk that experience for whatever it ends up buying for however many years. But it sounds like Take-Two is going to demand more from its titles and its consumers. And if those demands aren't met, or if Firaxis hopefully digs in and says, we're not compromising the integrity of our game experience, we'll take to abandon Civ, because it's not providing that kind of revenue they're chasing. And can Civ find a new publisher in that case, or will every entity big enough to support them be stuck in that microtransaction mindset? And finally, if they are going that route, as the Chief's words seem to imply, when would it start? The next installment, the next expansion pack, or the next patch? How long will we be able to enjoy the experience untainted by real gold becoming game gold?
It's already started a little bit. Look at the strength of DLC Civs compared to normal Civs. You're already seeing this a little, especially because now you can play DLC with non-DLC. You can play against people who don't have the DLC and use DLC Civs that are significantly stronger. I mean, there are some DLC Civs that are on par with things like Rome and whatnot. Like, they're good, but they're not fantastic. But some of
then you
DLC
have like Australia or Indonesia, and you're playing that against somebody who only has the vanilla Civs, and you're going to be a little bit overpowered.
Or Persia, or, I mean, okay, Aztec is free at least, but that too is extremely strong compared to most of the vanilla Civs. Now, like, these are still in the same neighborhood, but this kind of stuff creeps in. It's the same thing that happens with Europa Universalis series. They're pretty nuanced with it. The way they introduce stuff over time makes it increasingly dependent on you buying the DLC to get the full experience. Early DLC, that was less true. As you go on, they introduce mechanics that assume you have the previous DLC and patch out the ability to do old stuff. We can see that happen here. I mean, we got 2K over Civ. So, I mean, if you look at like NBA 2K or something, for example, the outlook's not good because we're talking 2K here.
Well, they said 48% of their revenue Take-Two comes from microtransactions now, from games like that and Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
Let me play the devil's advocate here. Now, the way that I look at this, games have not increased in price generally in the last 20 years or so. We've been paying $60 for a AAA game for how long now? At least since 2000. Given the nature of inflation, everything has doubled in price since then. So there's kind of halfway in between that we need to recognize that game developers aren't making as much money on the basic games as they used to. And that's kind of a problem if they can't support themselves from it, especially with the ballooning budget stuff.
Okay. I still think it's very dirty money to sell a retail title and then implement DLC in a way that locks the people who purchased a game out of the experience to a degree, to increasing degree over time, if they don't buy the DLC then. I really don't like that, especially that coincides with bug fixes and all that stuff as well. That's what I'm seeing a lot, at least in the strategy game genre.
We're talking Civ, and they never lock you out of stuff in the patches. We're due like Paradox does, where they put some stuff in the patch, but then there's, you know, to unlock it, you have to have the DLC. Civ has never done that.
Man, we're talking 2K, though. We are talking 2K.
No. I'm not
we
arguing
go the
that.
E4 route here. I don't want to see Civ go the EU4 route. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I just don't want people to be able to buy units, wonders, buildings with real money in the game.
That's fine.
That probably, or it's going to kill the game.
That part is fine because if you're dumb enough to spend money on something, well, you spent money.
Nobody
on it,
will
whatever.
Play with you.
Yeah, that'd be also your single player game.
They tried that with Civ World. It didn't work.
Yeah, obviously modders do a lot of that for free anyways. So for Civ side, if they tried to say, hey, buy these wonders, modders are like, but we made a lot of those, so meh. So yeah, I don't think on the Civ side you're really going to get that sort of thing. What you're going to get is what we basically get. A couple more Civs, a couple more of this, a couple more of that. It adds up for slightly more options. But it's not like, oh, I don't have this DLC, so I'm going to totally miss out on something. I'm okay with that.
Happened yet.
No,
it's 2K. I do not trust 2K. Yeah.
Obviously, what we're actually talking about here is more of that microtransaction in-game. Not DLCs like Civ does, but more in-game.
Yeah.
Right. Buying loot crates and crap like that.
we don't have an in-game avatar that stuff would apply to. So we're, for the moment, safe from that kind of thing.
Oh, no. You can definitely make a model with bullcrap. Yeah. Like, okay, you did this in-game. Here's a loot crate. And if you pay real money, you can now get special skins for X civilization. They absolutely can do crap like that. And yeah. I would expect to see that.
Oh, yeah, no,
somebody brought that up. If it's visual fluff, that's fine.
As long as it stays in that realm, yes. And League of Legends does that fantastically. Completely different game genre, but, it's free to play. Man, they make a lot of good money on their skins and stuff.
Yeah, I think part of it is, I mean, Ken has kind of alluded to it, because of Steam sales and other such things like that, where they might put out the game for $60, expecting to sell it to a million people so that they can afford the development money they put into it and future stuff for big games anyways. That's what they're expecting so that they can, you know, afford to pay for it. But Steam sales come along and cut the price down to $5 and all of a sudden they're getting almost nothing out of it. Things like that.
That doesn't happen as much anymore though. They've canceled a lot of the Steam sales stuff.
The devs can say not to do that too.
Yes.
Because RimWorld will never go on sale. Like, the dev has straight up said it. And it's to date that has been true. That it has never been on sale, even one time. So they have some say on that if they want to not do that.
The thought line is the free to play market is a thing, unfortunately. So if they say put out the game for way less money up front, then they're looking to monetize the experience of games that last 5-6 years, like League of Legends or other ones that were free to play like that. Therefore, they have to find a way to make money to pay for keeping them running for that long. So things like League of Legends, where there's actual servers and things that have to be paid for on a monthly basis, it does make a bit more sense that they try and find a way to constantly monetize it. Otherwise, those servers aren't going to get paid for and the game goes away. Stuff like Civ, where there are no servers for them to support, when they stop making content for it, they stop paying for it. So it doesn't make much sense to go for the freemium model.
I just did a little bit of math. Prices in the last 15 years have gone up by 25%.
Relative.
Relative to, like, U.S. inflation rate.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, most games are still $60.
So a game in 2005 at $50 is worth $62 now. So the price has stayed pretty much the same for 15 years.
Ish. Publishing companies want to make money. And if they feel like they're not making money off their product because they're spending like a crap ton of money on development.
Which is hard.
They'll try and find other ways. All right. So we done beating up on publishers for trying to make money off their games?
For now.
No, but we should stop for the moment, yes.
Okay.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
This has been Polycast 294. Without Dan Q, because he is tired from moving. We also have Makalua.
Yeah, moving. Well, I guess there was some movement involved.
Yeah, it's because that is moving to something.
Pretty tough when you're stationary completely.
I'm going to move towards some more caffeine, though.
And then the Mian team.
Peace. Haha, just kidding. Only after everything's conquered.
Mad Jin.
The countdown has begun.
Sedgwick.
Don't squander your 2 cents on cheap shots.
And me, Canis Albinus. Bye-bye.
I don't know, sometimes you get a good value for those cheap shots. Record date?
November 11th, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.